You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including an Abramsverse Trek game coming to consoles in 2012, some updates from J.J. and the writers on the next Star Trek movie, the science of Star Trek in the J.J. film, the Hero Complex Film Festival, and a TV pitch made by William Shatner for Star Trek in 2003. Our guest this week will be Five Year Mission, the Indianapolis-based band that writes original compositions based on TOS episodes. And we'll also be joined by two guest panelists, Lisa Lynch and Brian Finifter, as we talk about Abramsverse and how the J.J. Abrams Star Trek reboot fits into Star Trek overall, and whether longtime TOS fans can embrace the vision. So let's go ahead and step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How is everything today?
Everything is bright and sunny, Chris. How are you doing?
Oh, good. Bright and sunny for you. Well, it's gloomy and chilly down here, south of you.
That's crazy.
But that's rainy season for you.
Yeah. I'm sure tomorrow it'll be rainy up here.
Oh, I'm sure. And here, too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's good to be back this week. We missed the show last week.
Yeah, I missed talking to you.
Yeah, missed talking to you as well about Star Trek, and just had a few health things going on that I had to take care of, but I'm feeling a lot better now.
Yeah, very, very glad to have you up to speed and back talking about Star Trek with me.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. So let's just jump into news.
Sure.
We have a few topics today, and the focus of this show, of course, is going to be J.J. It's the J.J. show.
I think I'm supposed to be ringing a bell now because we're mentioning J.J. Abrams.
Oh, you're doing the bell today. Okay.
I've got a bell. You have something special, I think.
Yeah, I thought in this show I would just do a shot of tequila every time someone mentions JJ or lens flare.
Right. This should go well. By the end of the podcast, we'll see your arc as this continues.
Okay. We'll see how it goes at the end. Just note, there is no tequila.
No tequila. So,
it's 1:40 in the afternoon.
Either, sadly.
Okay, well, anyway, right on into news. So, first topic today in JJ World is video game news.
Yeah, we just had E3 this last week, which is the big, big video game conference in California. And I guess they announced cross-platform Star Trek game.
Yeah, they did. And I'm kind of excited about this because I'm mainly a console gamer or an iPhone gamer.
Right.
I don't play a lot of PC or Mac games. And so for a long time, I really wanted to have a nice Star Trek game on PlayStation 3. And there was that one game that came out around the time of the movie release called Star Trek Tactical Assault.
I don't remember this game. What was it?
It was pretty simple. I actually didn't play it because it didn't interest me, but I've watched demos of it. It's more like an overhead, just space battle game.
Oh, okay.
Kind of arcade-ish. I always took it as pretty much a movie tie-in marketing gimmick.
Just they threw it to some team in Korea to make in about 3 weeks, that sort of thing.
Maybe. But it was downloadable from the PlayStation Store.
Oh, okay.
I assume it was also for the Xbox marketplace.
Right.
And they had DS, PSP versions and so forth. Right. So, but this game here it's being produced by Digital Extremes and Paramount Digital Entertainment. Mm-hmm. And the footage that they showed was just pre-alpha footage at the Sony Entertainment of America keynote at E3.
Mm-hmm. Right. Nevertheless, it looked really good. Very detailed. The world looked... We should say it's based on the Abrams universe, but not necessarily the Abrams film.
Right. That's
so
right.
So it should have its own storyline, its own villain, and everything. So what I saw didn't look familiar to the movie, but it all looked... very much in the universe. You can run around the Enterprise. You can. There are various away missions you can go on. It looked very interesting.
Yeah, it did. And for pre-alpha footage, like you said, it looked very good. So I'm very hopeful based on that when they polish that game up.
Yeah. Did you ever play the Voyager games? I believe it was Elite Force.
No, I never played though. I've seen them. You know, the last Star Trek games, apart from Star Trek Online, the last Star Trek games that I really played go way back to like the Windows 3.195
wow.
period, the old TOS games.
Right.
And the next generation game called Final Unity, I believe it was. Which
Oh, I do remember that one.
Yeah, you know, I really wanted to get into that game, but it was Windows 95, and I spent most of my time trying to get my sound card to work with the game.
The early
Seriously.
Days of PC gaming.
That's right.
So much fun.
So I never really could get to play it, and I got into it for a little while, and then I reached some point in the game where the game just wouldn't play anymore on my machine, and I just gave up. So,
yeah, I remember the one experience with a Star Trek game I had, other than I think I played Final Unity at a friend's house, but my dad bought a Star Trek 3 game, and all I remember is that you were Kirk and you could punch. You can punch a lot of things, a lot of people.
Interesting. I don't remember that game.
I don't think the game was very deep. This could be my childhood remembrances, but
okay.
I've been looking forward to a real good... The next-gen games were mostly adventure games, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, they were. And there was a Deep Space Nine game for Windows called Harbinger, I believe.
Right.
Around 95, maybe.
So I've been looking for a good action game that's not necessarily a... first-person shooter like the Voyager games.
Yeah.
And this one has the interesting thing of having... You can play as either Kirk or Spock or doing co-op play with a friend. So it might be a little bit like Gears of War, which is really popular these days.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see. And you mentioned the story earlier being an original story. And they say the story is being written by the BAFTA Award winner and God of War writer Marianne Krawczyk.
Yeah, she's really good.
Probably mispronouncing her last name, but so they're bringing in a gaming veteran who's also working together with Orky Kurtzman, Lindelof, and Bad Robot to put together an original story for the game.
Right. And do we know yet if this is going to bridge between the first Abrams film and the second Abrams film, or have they said anything about that?
I haven't heard anything about that. My guess is that probably not. But you never know. I mean, it's slated for a 2012 release, so it would be on course with the movie,
right?
With the sequel, and knowing just as he did with Lost and with the first Star Trek film and everything else, it seems everything JJ does has some kind of big marketing tie-in,
right?
So it wouldn't surprise me, but I haven't heard anything like that.
It'd be strange to have the big game come out and the big movie come out in the same season and have no connection.
Yeah,
so I expect there'll be something.
Maybe so, yeah. So we have, there's a video, IGN put out some video of the trailer. And we have that on the Trek FM website, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes. So if you want to go and check out this, it's very short, but it's just a brief little video, and you can see some footage of the game.
Your dreams of being Zachary Quinto will come true.
That's right. Okay, so let's go on to the next JJ story.
Oh, yes.
For the all JJ show. and the next JJ story is just a little bit of talk about the sequel.
Right.
This was in an article that you found on Ain't It Cool News at ain'titcool.com.
Yeah. And of course, this is a big Abrams week because of the release of Super 8. Which is the Abrams Spielberg collaboration, sort of Goonies meets Close Encounters of the Third Kind meets E.T. meets, you know, your childhood. So I haven't seen the film. I don't think you have either because it's not been released in Japan. Is that right?
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but we are planning to go see it when
I'm
it comes
excited.
Out.
But so there's all this news and all these interviews, these press junkets that people are doing. And of course, everyone asked JJ, you know, what's going on with Star Trek II? So what did he say?
Well, it's most of this interview was about Super 8, and then at the very end, there's a little bit of Star Trek II tacked on, and one question that was asked of him was, it wasn't exactly this, but I think the point of the question was, are you doing a trilogy, like Star Trek 2, 3, 4 was a trilogy, although it wasn't originally intended to be a trilogy, it kind of turned out that way, but you've had other movies recently that have kind of been written with the eye of being a trilogy.
Right. I mean, they made the first Pirates movie and then said, oh, well, let's make it a trilogy, make two and three sort of connect to number one and have a big arc to it.
Yeah. So he said in response to that, that we're not writing these sequels in a row, you know, planning out a trilogy.
Right.
And they asked how many more films do you think this crew has? And he was being what I think is the typical cautious director. Same thing I would have said if I were in his position. He said, well, he hopes there's at least one more movie with this cast.
Right.
You know, I think there are probably quite a few more movies with this cast. I think the studio will continue making these movies as long as they bring in money.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to get ahead of yourself. You don't want to announce, you know, there's six movies coming down the pike.
Right.
I mean, unless you're Harry Potter and you have the books there, you just have to make them.
And then you know you're going to make, you know, millions and millions of dollars
on a movie,
no matter what.
Right. But it's obvious that the effort Paramount's put into casting the first movie and getting the all-star director and writers is the same thing that Marvel and Fox is doing with X-Men. They cast these really good actors for X-Men First Class, knowing that if the movie's a hit, they can just keep making them until, you know, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. And they cast Star Trek with very young actors.
Mm-hmm.
Who is the oldest actor? Is it Carl Urban?
It must be Carl Urban because he's in his mid to late 30s.
Okay. But even that, I mean, young. So,
oh, yeah.
So they can space these movies out three, four years apart and probably do five, six of these movies. Yeah.
I mean, I think Chris Pine has two or three movies before he starts getting a beer belly.
Okay. Well, that would be a good transition, you know, from, say, the original series to the Star Trek films.
We've got to keep the continuity.
Yeah,
you know?
We got to keep that up. So that's what he said about whether or not it's going to be a sequel. And he was also asked if he'll direct, which we talked about last time.
Big question.
And his answer was, we're waiting to get the script into shape.
Yeah.
I've been pretty busy getting Super 8 done, and I know that Bob, Damon, and Alex have been splitting their time as well, so I'm looking forward to jumping into Star Trek as soon as the Super 8 stuff is done.
Mm.
Which it just kind of sounds like, oh, and he says, I can't wait to actually be holding the script in my hand.
Right.
And it just sounds like he just wants to see what the story is to decide if he's going to direct, which... I don't know. I find it a little bit odd.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Well, I hope he's directs, but...
Yeah. I think it's producer's prerogative to be a little, you know, a little unsure. He doesn't want to commit himself to something in the press that he hasn't, you know, signed a contract for.
Yeah.
And I believe it's X-Men 3. Matthew Vaughn was going to direct that one. And then they got the script and... He just said, guys, I can't do this. This is a terrible script. You're not going to make me do it. And then you have a story, you know, where the director's quitting, the movie's falling apart, and the studio hates when that happens. They'd much rather, you know, have the director see the script, really commit to it, say, this is the film I definitely want to make before they make any announcements.
Yeah, and they weren't expecting that with X-Men 3, right? Because Lindsay Lohan wasn't in the movie. So you didn't expect you were going to have, you know... Actors having to drop out and director trouble.
And
so, well, we'll see. We'll see. I hope he directs this one anyway.
Yeah,
I'd like to
definitely.
Keep his vision. I'd like to see his vision one more time.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
Speaking of Super 8, now you told me that Super 8 both disappoints and astounds at the box office on its opening weekend.
Well, this was actually me pre-wondering what was going to happen because... It was tracking, Super 8 was tracking very oddly among U.S. audiences. You know, people sort of know who J.J. is. They definitely know who Spielberg is, but they don't know any of these kids. And the marketing was very cagey and not letting on what the plot is and definitely not showing the spoiler, the alien. They're not showing any of this. So I had no idea, you know, was this going to open huge or was it going to open, you know, really tiny and just disappoint everyone? And it ended up doing somewhere in the middle, you know, making about $40 million. So about as good as Cloverfield did back in 2008.
Yeah, it's not a bad opening.
Yeah.
I guess maybe some people were expecting it to be bigger,
right?
Being JJ, but so I've seen a little bit of reaction on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Seems mostly positive. Like people yeah. like the film, so you expect this to probably pick up in the second weekend. And
yeah, I definitely think this one's gonna keep rolling a little bit throughout the next few weeks. You know, it'll end up somewhere between 100, 150. It'll do really well on video. I don't know. I think JJ's name isn't quite big enough to pull off doing whatever he wants.
Yeah, maybe not.
I think if he were Christopher Nolan, he could make whatever he wants and people would say, oh, it's that guy. He's made two huge Batman movies. He made that weird movie with Hugh Jackman that I saw because, you know, I love Hugh Jackman. I'll go see this Inception thing, even though I have no idea what it is. So maybe after another Star Trek, JJ will have that sort of, you know, cachet.
So you
I'm
don't
not
think
sure if he has it yet.
You don't think the television notoriety from Lost and so forth is enough to carry over to the big screen?
I think people actually have a, in my opinion, people have an idea of JJ that he's very genre oriented because he made Lost and he made Alias. Mm-hmm. And they forget that he also made Felicity and several other of these more mainstream ideas. So I think a lot of people want to pigeonhole JJ into being just for geeks and that this is a movie for geeks, which I don't really think it is. And so while the geek audience is kind of turning out, they're not getting that family audience that they really want.
Yeah. Well, maybe the word of mouth will.
It's very possible. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to another Trek focus here. And this is just a little tidbit item. It's kind of funny. This is planking.
Yes.
Tell us what planking is.
Now, planking is, this is new to me. Apparently, you lay down flat with your arms on your side and have someone take a picture of you next to a object or on top of an object.
Okay.
This is, I hear it's all the rage, but you know, being in Japan, I miss out on this. So it may be huge. You might not have heard of it either.
Well, I haven't seen anybody planking down at the train station, but so in this case, planking, it's Damon Lindelof and
right.
Roberto Orci are planking as they take a break from working on the Star Trek II script.
And I believe they're planking in front of a Han Solo in carbonite reproduction.
That's right. That's what they're doing.
Which, that's not extremely Star Trek related, but...
No. But you know, they did talk about in commentary for the Star Trek film that they pulled a bit of Star Wars /
right.
Joseph Campbell mm-hmm. inspiration of, you know, Luke looking at the twin suns when...
Yep.
When Kirk rides up on his motorcycle and looks at the Enterprise under construction
right.
in the shipyards. So maybe this Han Solo and carbonite here is kind of like their inspiration. Maybe
awesome.
They were having writer's block and planking in front of Han is how they get the words flowing again.
It's very possible. It's very possible.
So
I just hope that Zachary Quinto doesn't end up encased in carbonite at the end of the next Star Trek film. That's all I ask.
Okay.
At least call it something else.
That's
all I ask.
Well, they'll call it Latinum. He's encased in Latinum. And then some Star Trek continuity fans will say that, well, they don't use Latinum yet or something like that. But
nerds.
The one more thing on this. This photo, we have a photo that was tweeted by Lindelof, I think.
Right.
And we'll put that on the site in the show notes. But the question posed here was, what have we learned from this photo? A, Damon is a nerd.
Yes.
B, they are still writing the sequel.
Good to know.
Or C, Bob is a nerd too. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yes.
So
I think all those things are very good to know, actually.
Yeah, and I think it's D, all of the above.
But... All of the above, yes.
All right. Well, staying on the topic of the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie, mm-hmm. Next item is an article written by Andy Howell, who is an astronomer at the Las Cumbres Observatory and a faculty member at UC Santa Barbara. And his focus is supernovae. Right. And he wrote an article, again, on Ain't It Cool News at ain'titcool.com, about the science of Star Trek, specifically Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams movie.
Right.
Because there have been a number of science of Star Trek over the years, most notably the book by Lawrence Krauss, which is a really good book if you haven't read it. I haven't read the latest version of it. I read it when it originally came out, and I think there's an updated version that kind of brings the technology.
Yeah, I need to pick this up.
Things like talking about hard drive capacities and all, which would be a bit dated now. I think there's a new revised version.
Right.
But you should pick that up if you haven't read it. But in this article, this article is interesting because I was watching the other day, I was watching an episode of The Universe on the History Channel, and it was about science fiction, technology, and reality, and what technologies or what elements of science in science fiction will soon become reality and which ones are just pure fiction.
Oh, interesting.
And that show was done after the J.J. Abrams movie was released. And, of course, they talked to various different scientists on each episode of The Universe. And several of them were pointing out problems with the science in the J.J. Abrams movie and how distracting it is for them as scientists trying to watch the movie and trying to give the writers creative license, but yet not let some of these things spoil the movie for them.
Yeah. I mean, I just watched the movie again this morning in preparation for our future topic. And as soon as Spock starts talking about a supernova exploding and then it's going to, you know, take over the galaxy unless they put a black hole inside of it and then it engulfs Romulus. And, you know, I'm not much of an astronomer, but I know this makes no sense whatsoever as I'm watching it.
Right. That makes no sense. Not to mention the red matter bit that's going on.
Yeah.
So that's what is most frequently cited by scientists and fans as being kind of a problem with the science in this movie. And that's what Howell talks about primarily. He talks about, one thing he mentions first is when Kirk is marooned on the snowy planet, which I'm going to assume he was marooned on the northern poles because he's the shuttle pod computer tells him it's a Classium planet, yet it's like snowing and it's frozen, so it's probably not really a Classium planet. But anyway, it's called Delta Vega, which Howell points out can't be the Delta Vega from the original series. And this planet is supposed to be nearby Vulcan because Nero has stranded Spock there so that he can watch Vulcan as it's being devoured by this black hole. But yet Vulcan is so large in the sky that Delta Vega would actually have to be the same distance from Vulcan that our moon is from Earth.
Yeah.
And if it were an actual planet, it would then have to be a binary planetary system. Just all kinds of crazy stuff about that.
Yeah, so I think this is a case of you know, filmic license. The script originally said he was looking at it in a telescope, but it's obviously much more dynamic to have a shot with Spock in the front and Vulcan being destroyed in the back, and then you show, you know, Spock with his mouth agape as he watches it, rather than just, you know, peering through a telescope.
Yeah.
But still, it strains credulity because you're trying to watch it, and you're, you know, the intelligent parts of your brain are telling you, you know, it can't be that close. It just can't. It can't be that close.
Yeah, it can't be that close.
Don't believe what you're watching.
This one didn't really bother me that much because, like you said, I just chalk it up to creative license. Obviously, for the audience, it's much more effective to see Vulcan caving in on itself like that than, you know, to have him peering through a telescope. Yeah. So, but that was one thing that he pointed out. He also points out that another bit of creative license here, that if you could actually do what was being done in the first place, it would take about half an hour for the planet to cave in on itself like this, rather than a few seconds, which we see on the screen. But getting to the real thing here about the black hole and the supernova. First of all, supernova cannot destroy a galaxy.
No.
To start with, I mean, supernova go off about once every 100 years, somewhere around the galaxy. And the galaxy is still here, all of these billions of years later. And the other thing is that apparently the star that is going supernova is not Romulus's sun. It's another star. So,
because there's apparently time for them, for it to explode, and then people know about it and travel, you know, because supposedly Spock was en route when Romulus was destroyed. So it takes a while for the shockwave, I suppose, to go from the star to where Romulus is.
Right.
But that's, as you're saying, that's not how supernovas work.
Right. Yeah, that's what would be the case. And that would be if it was actually the star that Romulus is orbiting, which apparently it's not. But Howell here, this I think really bugs him about the movie. So he spent a good bit of time talking about this. And he said just doing the calculations that for the star to go supernova, it would have to be at least eight times the mass of our sun. Which means that for Romulus to be habitable, Romulus would have to be about 10 times further away from the star than we are from our sun, which means that once the star went supernova, the material from the exploding star would not reach Romulus for 42 hours. Right. Yet, Spock, in this super advanced, high-speed jellyfish ship, miscalculated 42 hours and was en route to the star when it went nova and didn't get there in time, and then Romulus was destroyed. So this, I think, for the scientific-minded kind of spoils this movie part of the way through for them.
I think it really does. And so this article is definitely worth reading because he really delves into the nitty-gritty of what problems scientists have when they see movies like this.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll put a link to this up there anyway on the show notes, and also in the Enhanced Podcast you can click through and you can read Howell's entire take on the science there.
And while you're at it, also watch The Core and see how other problems movies have with following science.
Oh, yes.
Not just Star Trek.
Okay. Guy, I don't remember if I even saw that.
Oh, it's worth seeing just for the science.
I remember reading a very similar book, but I don't remember the name now. Anyway, next up, while we're on the topic of the movies, the Hero Complex Film Festival took place in Los Angeles at the Chinese Six Theater. And they screened 8 films, and they had live Q&A sessions with the filmmakers. And there were 2 films included in the festival from the Star Trek franchise. And can you guess which 2 films these were?
I believe it was Wrath of Khan, and then the brand new movie by J.J. Abrams.
Oh, I thought for sure you were going to say the motion picture and The Voyage Home.
I would have loved to see them. No.
Right. So, yes, it was The Wrath of Khan and J.J. Abrams' Star Trek. Yeah.
And we actually have with us later in the show a young man who was actually at this film festival. So hopefully we can ask him a little bit about what happened. But I believe we have some like transcripts of these Q&As we can talk about.
We do have some bits of transcripts anyway. I'm not sure if we have the full ones, but if we do, we'll get those in the show notes. And so Nicholas Meyer was there after Wrath of Khan.
Right. Now, would you say Nicholas Meyer is your, I'm going to put you on the spot here, your favorite Trek director?
Oh, gosh. Favorite Trek director.
As far as the movies,
at least. Well, he's up there. I have to say he's probably one of my favorite creative mind / director in the film franchise, because he is the mind behind Wrath of Khan and The Undiscovered Country.
Right.
You know, I did really enjoy Leonard Nimoy's directing of 3 and 4 as well. But I guess Nicholas Meyer probably. And Frakes for First Contact, although Frakes for Insurrection maybe.
Yeah.
Not so much.
Yeah, but I think because of Insurrection. Yeah. So I would say that they had at this film festival at least my two favorite of the Trek directors. So that would have been a really exciting thing to be there for.
Yeah, it definitely would have been. And for the JJ film, they had Orky Kurtzman, Lindelof for a Q&A. Mm-hmm. And the couple of tidbits here, and we'll put the links up in the show notes. They did confirm that they won't be doing a Khan remake for the next film. So I was glad to hear that. Not that I thought they were going to, but it's just nice to kind of put that to rest.
Good to hear confirmation. I wouldn't mind seeing Khan show up down the line, but I think for the next movie, they should strike out, do completely their own thing. Just to, you know, we've talked about this in the past, but it's good to hear them talk about it.
Well, you know, we did our poll on Trek FM as well. Mm-hmm. Whom would you like to see in the next Star Trek movie as the villain?
Now, tell me a guy won.
A guy. I don't know if a guy got any votes. Now, Gary Mitchell got some votes. He's a guy.
Yeah, that's true.
Trelane's a guy. He got some votes. Horta got some votes, but I'm not sure if Horta's a guy.
I don't think so.
He's hot, but not sure if he's a guy. But the other important thing here that they did reveal, Orky said that he's been rewatching every episode of the original series over the past 2 years. But he wouldn't say which elements from TOS they're going to pull into the sequel. But very importantly, make sure everyone pays attention here. He did confirm that they will not be using Spock's brain as inspiration for the next Star Trek film.
Disappointment.
So, yeah, I'm disappointed too, but it's out there. It's confirmed, so too bad. Maybe in Star Trek 3.
I'm actually not quite sure I've ever seen Spock's brain, to be honest.
Oh, gosh. Well, go to YouTube and watch Spock's brain condensed. It's like a 4-minute condensed version of Spock's brain.
I'll have to check it out.
And as funny as the full episode is, this condensed version is much better. So let's put a link to that, too, because if you haven't seen that, you have to watch that.
In the show notes.
All right. Well, last little bit of news here before we take a break.
This may be actually not Abrams related. I'm astonished.
It's not Abrams related.
You this can is take a break the from one, the tequila.
Yeah, we've entered the Abrams free zone for a minute. This is about William Shatner and a Trek TV series pitch that he made back in 2003 that was intended to replace Enterprise as it was suffering in the ratings.
Right.
I guess it was Captain Kirk to the rescue, but so tell us about this pitch.
Yeah. Now, I don't think he would have been in the TV show, but he would have served as a producer and providing the story. And this would have been an Academy movie, much like the...
Well, an Academy series.
An Academy series. Yeah. Much like we've heard talked about in the past, and then we sort of got in the new movie, although they sped through it pretty quickly. This would have been all about Kirk and Spock going through Starfleet Academy.
Yeah. Which is an idea that was... You know, it's interesting. This idea was kicked around a lot before Enterprise came out, kind of in the couple of years, maybe 2000 especially. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there was any connection. Well, no, I don't think Shatner was connected in any way to that. It's just this Academy idea has just been kicked around over and over and over. And then now we hear that Shatner kind of actually pitched this in 2003.
Right.
So. There's a novel, a Shatner novel, that he wrote together with Judith and Garfield Reeve Stevens, who he always writes with them pretty much, called Collision Course.
Right.
And apparently this whole pitch that he had made, this concept, when it wasn't picked up, was fleshed out in the novel Collision Course. So if you're curious about it, pick up that
novel. It looks like it would have been his entire pilot concept fleshed out in a story. And then he was planning on going through and having a whole series of novels, but it looks like that didn't happen. And they've actually hired some other writers to do novels based on the Abrams verse, Starfleet Academy.
Yeah, now they're doing the Starfleet Academy novels that are aimed more at the youth audience.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad they didn't do this series personally. As we've said before, I guess last week we were talking about the future of Trek on TV, and I mm-hmm. not really interested in an Academy series.
Yeah, I don't think it'd be that interesting. The core of Star Trek, what's really interesting is one ship going off into the unknown, or at least with DS9, a space station out in the middle of nowhere, away from everything. I don't think I want to see every week, what life is like in Utopia. That's just not quite that interesting to me, and especially not to see, day-to-day tests and relationships and all of the dealing with being a teenager. That doesn't, doesn't sound fun.
Yeah, because like we said before, it would probably turn into Beverly Hills 90210 for Star Trek.
Exactly.
I think after one season anyway, if not sooner.
Let's see, Beverly Hills 1701. Would that be
maybe
the joke
that would
to
be
made?
It. Yeah. All right. So that's Shatner's Trek TV pitch, and that pretty much wraps up our Trek news for today. We're very excited to be joined today by 5-Year Mission, a collaboration of 5 Star Trek fans who, in their own words, write and play songs. Specifically, they take episodes of the original Star Trek and write songs for them. Welcome to the Ready Room, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Let's start with a quick introduction of each of you and tell the listeners what you do in the band.
I'm Chris. I write some of the songs. I also play guitar, bass, I play everything but drums, as we all do.
Okay.
Patrick?
I'm Patrick. I also write songs, and I play a lot of the lead guitar type stuff, but I also play, keys, bass, etc.
Keys.
He plays keys on one song.
On one song.
That's an exaggeration.
We all play everything except for Andy.
Yeah. Andy sucks. He just plays one thing.
That just means I'm really good at that one thing.
I'm Mike. I play guitar and bass and keyboards, and I write songs and I sing. So, sort of.
I'm Andy. I just play drums.
I'm Noah, and I write songs and play all the instruments except for drums.
All right. So I remember on Twitter, you mentioning before that you guys swap in and out all the instruments. I'm curious, one of the first things I wanted to ask you, you probably get asked this a lot, is how did you guys all meet and how did you come to form a TOS tribute band?
Everyone's looking at me. we all met because we're all veterans of the Indianapolis music scene. The four of us, other than Andy, we all have known each other for, some of us for like more than 10 years. But we kind of all just kind of played in shows together in different bands. And about 2 years ago, I had the idea to write songs for episodes of Star Trek. And I was going to do the whole thing myself. But then I decided to invite Noah because he wanted to borrow my Next Generation box set. So that was a good sign. And then we just kind of recruited everybody as we went. And Andy was the last one we recruited because we needed a drummer, and he was available.
Gee, thanks for that.
So what was the moment when it came to you that I want to write songs about every Star Trek episode? When was that exact moment?
Well, I was watching an episode called The Zeppo, and
Buffy episode.
The Zeppo.
It was actually an idea I had a long time ago, even longer than 2 years ago. I was going to start a Buffy the Vampire Slayer band, and I was going to have Patrick join the band.
I wrote 3 songs for it.
and then he moved to California, so I scrapped the idea. And then, I don't know, one day I was just kind of watching Star Trek, and I was just becoming really obsessed with it. Because before, about maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I was just a casual fan. And then I just became addicted to it, and I was watching it every day, and then I just decided that that was going to be the project.
Okay, interesting.
Is that too long-winded?
No, that was great. It's very interesting, and I've never thought of the idea of a Buffy the Vampire Slayer tribute band before. So, What was the name of that band going to be?
I was going with Hostel 17, but we hadn't decided.
That band already exists.
Does it?
Well, I'm glad that you formed this band. I thought you guys might be interested to know, since I came across Five Year Mission, you guys have kept my iTunes very busy and shot up the charts of my most played artists. I checked my Last FM page, and you guys are number 3.
Wow.
You're right after, I have very diverse musical tastes. You're right after Duran Duran, Taylor Swift, then there's Five Year Mission, then the Dead Milkman, and
yes!
the
Counting Crows. Yes!
And they might be giants, so you're right there.
I recognized your icon when it was up on the screen from Last FM. I'm typically the one that goes in there and checks and manages the Last FM site, and I'm like, that's who that is.
That's who that is. That's me, yeah. Well, another question I had for you guys is, I'm a designer, so I'm very interested in the creative process, and a lot of the songs you play, the story is very straight, like Where No Man Has Gone Before. Very straight. And then in some songs, you pick up these very small elements. My favorite being in Balance of Terror, where your focus is on the wedding being ruined by the Romulans. And so I'm curious, can you tell me a little bit about your creative process? How do you guys watch an episode and decide what element you're going to pick up for your songs?
That's kind of one of the most interesting things about it, I think, because it's kind of directed writing. You have something to start with, but you can pretty much take it in any direction you want. I think all four of us that do the writing, that's one of the things we like the most about it, is we can pretty much have a wide open canvas as far as whatever we want to do with it. I've noticed different approaches. You know, I do a lot of things to do with like the theme of the episode maybe, or like the mood of the episode. I've noticed that Chris will pick like a particular moment or character to focus on a lot of the time. Mike seems to be the storyteller that likes to just sort of recount what happens in the episode. And Noah does the same thing, but he's more artistic, I think, as far as his approach.
Thanks.
Noah uses more chords. That's what he means.
He uses what?
Noah uses more chords.
Yes, more chords.
Yeah.
He makes them up.
No, but I mean, there's no set way that we do it. We just we each have our own approaches.
I think sometimes the episode decides for itself.
Absolutely.
Like, I entered a lot of times not knowing what I'm going
to
focus on, and just something will jump out while you're watching the episode, and you grab onto that, and that's where it goes.
I don't think I ever know what. I mean, I start out, and I just kind of, I think the first episode that I did was Dagger of the Mind, and that one was pretty straightforward, and, you know, I wanted the piece in the middle that's kind of erratic, that's, you know, that comes from the guy who's, you know,
the
bonkers.
Crazy guy who pops out of a
Gelder, who's like, yeah. But but you know, I didn't want to do that every time. I wanted to try to, you know, I try to look, do it from different perspective, different characters. With Balance of Terror, I just, you know, there's what was expected was for me to, you know, go with the whole Romulans versus Kirk kind of thing. But then I saw this, you know, there was this backstory happening where this couple. Their relationship is destroyed. And I just thought that was an interesting piece of the story that you don't think about. And so I wanted to go with that. So I always try to find something unique about the story, or just, you know, anything that, tells me, hey, this is what you got to write this story about.
And sometimes there'll be a musical cue in the episode, like with Miri, the bonk, bonk on the head chanting.
Yeah, I love that.
It's pretty much a given right there.
Yeah.
Or in Charlie X, where Spock is, you know, recounting lines of poetry against his will. Stuff like that.
Right.
So those kind of things. And they even play a song, Spock and Uhura play a song in the episode. So things like that can contribute to what ends up happening with it, too.
I see. Very interesting. And sometimes a play on words, like, I sure want to leave.
Right. Thanks, Mike.
And speaking of the wedding, in Shore Leave, you mentioned how quickly she got over the death of her fiance as well. So you kind of have themes running from track to track as well.
If you could have heard the unedited version.
Eight minutes long.
Yeah, there was a lot more going on. Next little observations.
I even referenced Next Generation and Enterprise in my lyrics in the original.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We demanded it be reined in so that it would only be TOS, but maybe someday we'll bring out the original version just for kicks.
Greatest hits album.
Yeah.
So it makes me wonder, when you get to Mirror, Mirror, are you guys going to become evil?
Yes. We're all going to grow goatees.
We talked about.
You're going to put goatees on when you play live, right?
Absolutely. Oh,
of course.
this has been long discussed already.
Okay. And a lightning storm on the stage, right?
Yeah.
We'll attempt it. We'll see what happens.
We'll see if we can make everything look like it's a negative and flip, back and forth.
We'll use that for the alternative factor, too.
Yeah. Right.
Well, speaking of future songs, can you give us any teasers on year two and what you're working on?
Well,
we just laid down the drums for about six songs total. And we have them all written. They're all in demo form, but we've started doing the real recording for about six of them.
We started playing them live, too.
Yeah, right, we play about half of them live far, and we've got about three-fourths of them that we worked on as a band. So we're coming along.
It's getting there.
Very eclectic, of course.
So are we.
Yeah, it's kind of a bigger version of year one. Like the range expands even farther for the different genres and styles that we're doing.
I think the ideas we had were bigger, and the range of styles.
Yeah,
definitely. Mm-hmm. There's a wider range of styles.
There's a lounge type song.
I was about to say that. Yeah.
And which episode is the lounge song?
The alternative,
alternative factor.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, it's alternative.
We've got kind of a Eastern meditation. We've got, what was yours, Chris? Kind of
a Western swing. We've got
arena rock. Arena rock. Or, of course, arena. Right. Which will be a fun one that the kids might want to fast forward through if they have six years in the chorus.
Well, it's
pretty.
Say it on TV.
Yeah.
Well, 60s pop, kind of a mariachi band song.
Yeah.
What else? What else have we got?
We had some just straight up good old fashioned
rockers. Oh yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that'll be a fairly eclectic mix for a fairly eclectic 16 episodes.
Okay, I'm looking forward to that. And that just brings me back. I have to ask this question. You're probably asked this often. Whose idea was the Corbinite maneuver?
Oh, that was mine.
I love the Corbinite maneuver.
Oh, thanks.
And
we were going to ask you for a round of Tranya, actually.
And who is it that loves it so much that they bought the company?
That would be Harold Mudd.
Harcourt.
Spendin' Mudd, sorry.
Harcourt.
Excuse me, his name is Harcourt.
I just wanted someone to give that speech, and he seemed like your typical character that would be trying to pass off something that didn't exist and make money off of it, and so he became the speaker.
Very good point.
But of course, using his alias from Mudd's Women instead of his actual name. So there's a little bit of trivia.
Sneaky.
Leo Walsh, yeah.
Oh, that's right. And of course, I'm sure you can guess that the episode that I am most looking forward to, which I suspect will not come yet on year two, is your take on Spock's brain. Have you given any thought to this yet?
That'll be on year four.
Yeah, with the way the songs are split up, that'll end up being on year four. That'll definitely be an interesting one.
That sounds like a Mike episode.
We'll give that one to Mike. Thanks.
Well, I know you guys have a lot of things coming up. I wanted to ask you about and have you fill in the listeners on some events coming up where you're performing Trek Fest in conjunction, Comic Rocks 2, and so forth. Can you tell us a little bit about what you have planned in the busy month of July?
coming weekend, June 24th, we're going to be at Trek Fest in Riverside, Iowa, which is the future birthplace of Captain Kirk. Self-proclaimed future birthplace of Captain Kirk.
But Roddenberry approved.
Do they have that seal on the city limit sign? Roddenberry approved?
Oh, yeah. There's a giant plaque that
they
get their picture taken next to. If you go to the Trek Fest website, there's always a picture on the front page of someone standing next to it.
It's canon.
And then the very next weekend, we're coming back to Indianapolis, and we're going to be at In Conjunction, which is a sci-fi convention here in town that they have every year. and we're playing for their annual dance. Then the following Saturday after that, then we're playing a Comics Rocks showcase, which is for art and music. It's a bunch of artists come to the show, and then there's burlesque girls who dance, and they all draw the girls, and then they win prizes for the best drawings.
And the burlesque,
but not as creepy as he makes it sound.
Yeah, yeah. This is the second year that they're doing it, and it's this year's Star Trek themed, because we're the headlining band, and supposedly the girls are going to dress up in Star Trek costumes. So we're hoping for some Orion slave girls.
Yeah, I was going to say some Orion slave girls will be there, I'm sure.
And then the very next weekend after that, we're playing an all ages festival here in Indianapolis as well. That's called Pirate Fest.
All right. Well, it's interesting. So many things. You guys are in big demand.
Oh, well, then, but this still that doesn't cover Starbase Indy in December, and then also Gen Con.
Yeah, Gen Con in August, and we're going to the Chicago Con in August, but we don't know if we're playing yet or not.
All right.
Yeah,
well, you can always take your instruments and just start playing.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
We intend.
Apart from these big events, how often are you guys able to perform in the Indianapolis area?
We
usually get out at least once a month.
Yeah, we
it just kind of depends
typically
on what's going on.
Every other month.
Yeah,
just
we try to only do it for events. We don't want to just become the regular every week band that you can see anytime. We want to play special events and make it a big deal every time we play.
But we do hope to do more of these conventions and that sort of thing, because that's
our core audience.
Concentrated yeah. fan base of those.
We're hoping to get hooked up with Creation?
Creation Entertainment.
And try and get on some of the official Star Trek conventions. That would be pretty cool.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. I mean, you guys should be playing like Star Trek Las Vegas.
Yes,
we should. That's worth it.
You should. No, seriously.
So basically, for Creation Entertainment listening.
Yeah, if you're listening, we're out here.
We're in. Yeah.
We're available.
Well, let's just jump ahead here and tell Creation Entertainment where they can go and find you guys, find your album, find your music, find you all around the web.
Well, our official website is 5yearmission.net. You can go there for, you can actually order the CD, a physical copy of the CD from there. We also just recently added an online merch store, which also now includes plenty of new merchandise, including buttons, new stickers, and you can finally get shirts from the website as well, which do come in blue, yellow, and red, depending on if you want to dye or not.
Plus, there's links on our website to all of our other sites, like Facebook and Twitter and all that.
iTunes, CD Baby, everything like that. So we're available everywhere. Just look up 5-Year Mission. We're the first thing that comes up on Google.
And you also have embeds from YouTube of your episode clips set to your songs as well.
Yes,
right.
There are there's 8 of them up now, right?
Yeah.
And if you're a lucky person who comes out in person to our show, or somehow prove yourself as a dedicated fan, we also have DVDs available to just select people for free of all 16 videos. And we're kind of not going to release all 16 on YouTube, so that people have.
Special. There's a couple acoustic performances on there too.
Yeah,
that's
there's
right.
also some acoustic.
You can see Noah and Andy playing an accordion together.
Yeah,
that's a team.
Tandem accordion. Sort of like one steering and one applying the brakes and then accelerating. kind of like midgets driving a car.
Exactly.
Yeah, we want that out there.
But it sounds interesting, doesn't it? People want to see it.
I would pay to see that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people will pay to see that.
Chris?
All right.
And Andy plays a tambourine with his foot.
I do.
And a chair.
And a chair.
I play xylophone.
With a xylophone.
With one hand while I'm playing the accordion.
That's right.
Yeah, it's an interesting acoustic performance that we do on the DVD.
Quite.
And you can only get it if you come to our shows.
All right. Yep. Well, awesome. I'm calling my travel agent right now. Get from Tokyo to Indianapolis, and well, any chance you guys are set up to play?
Yeah,
Sure.
Cool.
Yes.
We can be.
So, an acoustic performance. I was thinking what would be the best acoustic performance, and the one that came to my mind first was actually The Menagerie.
But, do it!
What do you guys think?
I wholeheartedly agree with both Menageries right now.
They know there was a.
We were actually just joking the other day because both Chris and Patrick, who both performed Menageries Part 1 and 2 respectively,
we haven't played it since we recorded it.
They've pretty much forgotten how to play their own songs.
Well, this should be interesting.
Yeah, that's hilarious, Andy. I think it's funny.
Do you want to try it?
Oh, you're actually going to do this one?
I don't know.
We'll see how it goes.
I don't know if I'm going to remember this at all.
Okay, this is Menagerie Part 1.
I once was the captain of the Enterprise. In case you remember me, Christopher Pye. Just 13 years, but a lifetime ago. On Delos 4, first officer, Mr. Spock was there too. But you won't recall names of the rest of my crew. When I reflect back on the ship personnel, they were unremarkable but damn professional. I was the hero, I was exploring strange new worlds. I was the hero, I was the one who always got the girl, got the girl. I had an accident saving the day. Gum on the machine, the man here on display. Stop to think of opportunities missed. But I can't cry cause my face stays frozen like this. I was the hero, I was exploring strange new worlds. I was the hero, I was the one who tried but lost all motor functions instead. Wanna think of a device just like Mac and Talk Fred. We could continue watching the transmission, but why not wait until next week till it's done? Yeah. I once was the captain of the Enterprise. In case you remember me, Christopher Pye. Just 13 years, but a lifetime ago. Stopped to investigate on Talos 4. I was the hero, I was exploring strange new worlds. I was the hero, I was the one who always got the girl. I was the hero, I was exploring strange new worlds. I was the hero, I was the one who always got the girl, got the girl.
Alright, good job.
That was much better than I expected.
Yeah, it was.
Great.
I really didn't know if I would remember any of that when we started.
That's not even the part that I play.
That was great, guys. Thanks so much for playing that.
Thanks.
Sure.
Thanks for asking me.
You want to hear something new?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Something off year two?
Oh, that would be great. I would love that.
What's Spacey?
Yeah.
Spacey.
Okay. All right, you ready, Chris?
I hope so.
All right.
We'll see.
Ready?
Let's try it.
All aboard
First there's Khan. He almost died. He may have fooled LT MacGyvers, but he's not a nice guy. Kirk and Spock and Bones try to research where these people have been. It turns out that they are relics from the eugenics wars. Superior in every way plus years on a sleeper ship, and now their Napoleonic leader is away. He's Khan Noonien Singh. Khan Noonien Singh. Khan Noonien Singh. Take over. Had a big dinner to disguise an inquest. Spock asked all the questions while Kirk sat back and listened in. He'd had enough. Khan proceeded his plan. Tried to take over the ship, every woman and man. Threatened for their loyalty or else he'd do the captain in. But Kirk proved more formidable than Khan thought he'd be. When in engineering, a battle ensued. Khan said, I have five times your strength, you're no match for me. But after an epic battle, Kirk ended the feud. Khan was marooned on SETI Alpha 5. It would be a challenge to keep he and his people alive. But when asked to serve in heaven, he said he'd rather rule in hell. It would be interesting, Captain, to return to that world in 100 years and learn what crop had sprung from that seed that you planted today. With Khan Singh, Khan Singh, Khan Singh, Khan Singh.
Spacey. Come on!
Little rough.
Oh, that was great. I like that. And that was the storyteller song.
Yeah. One of those. Yeah.
I thought you might take the angle of telling the backstory of the artist who painted the painting of Khan.
I don't know if I could get enough material out of that one. I mean, with Khan, you just, I mean, it's got to be about Khan. It's got to be, you know, Spacey, so. I just went with kind of the obvious, but I wanted, hopefully, ideally, that'll be kind of a, we've talked about the style, and it's going to be kind of that grand, you know, Beatles Magical Mystery Tour, Sergeant Pepper kind of thing with horns and fun stuff. And
we'll hand claps, too.
We'll see how that works out.
Touch of psychedelia.
Yeah.
Well, it's, I like the acoustic version, so I can't wait to hear with the horns. And well, thanks so much for the preview of year two. That was wonderful. Well, we've got to get you guys on the radar of creation and get you out to Star Trek Las Vegas.
We would enjoy that very much.
that would be very agreeable.
It seems the logical,
most logical progression.
It is the only logical thing to do. All right. Well, thanks again for joining us today, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That was Noah Butler, Andy Fark, Patrick O'Connor, Mike Rittenhouse, and Chris Spurgeon of 5-Year Mission. Check them out at 5yearmission.net. So, the J.J. Abrams reboot of Star Trek has ruffled the feathers of quite a few original series Star Trek fans, but it's been embraced by a lot of others as a great shot in the arm for the franchise. And today we're going to talk about Abramsverse versus the original series. And along with Greg, we're joined by two guests today. We have Lisa Lynch and we have Brian Finifter. Lisa, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Hi. yes, I am been on Twitter for a while, and it's kind of where I've really started. The movie actually got me interested in Star Trek. I, of course, have watched it growing up on and off, but I didn't really get interested until the 2009 movie. It was streaming on Netflix at the time, so I decided to go ahead and compare it to the movie and found that I would just fell in love with it really hard. So I joined Twitter and found a whole bunch of like-minded people and just kind of been going nuts ever since.
Okay, so you watched Star Trek growing up, but you kind of got into TOS more via JJ.
Exactly, yeah.
It's kind of an interesting
path. I mean, it was just kind of part of my background. I was born about the same time it had its resurgence in 72. Mm. There I am dating myself, but it was part of my life, but not something I really thought about too much.
Interesting. All right. And Brian, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm a lifelong Star Trek fan. I've been a fan really pretty much for as long as I can remember. My sister is about 10 years older than me, and she was into it, and it was definitely a case of whatever the older sibling is into, that's what you're into. So that's how it started off. And I've been a huge Star Trek nerd pretty much my entire life, going back to, you know, pretty much I grew up on The Next Generation. I also watched the original series, of course, but going back to The Next Generation when that was on television in the late 80s, early 90s.
Were you wearing one of those little small Star Trek uniforms for babies when you were little?
No. My mom never put me in one of those. She's not much of a fan herself, but yeah.
All right. So, well, let's jump into Abramsverse a little bit. I guess a good jumping in point here is just the whole concept of a reboot. You know, after Enterprise kind of flopped in the ratings for various reasons, there seemed to be a disinterest on the part of the studio in Star Trek for a couple of years there. We had no Star Trek on TV. Nemesis pretty much seemed to have killed the film franchise. And even the web presence like StarTrek.com just languished for several years with almost no updating to the site. And parts of it were broken for a couple of years and never repaired. And then in 2006, we find out that J.J. Abrams is going to be brought in to do a reboot of Star Trek. As lifelong Star Trek fans, how do you feel about whether or not Star Trek needed to be rebooted in the first place? How about you, Greg? What did you feel when you heard this announcement?
Yeah, obviously I was really into Star Trek from late Next Gen on, and I was really excited about everything Star Trek, and then got really disappointed as the movies sort of got less good and Enterprise got less good, and I became less of a Star Trek fan as time went on. And then I got into Lost, and hearing that the guy who made Lost was remaking Star Trek was actually really exciting to me. I think we got a trailer for it a long time before the actual movie came out. So there's a long time for me to think about it and mull over. But I thought it sounded like a great idea.
How about you, Brian?
I'm kind of in the same boat. It became progressively harder and harder to be a Star Trek fan as the time went on, and you know, because I watched Voyager, and Voyager, in my opinion, started out somewhat promising and then just completely fell apart as it went along. And then, you know, I was always a huge Next Generation fan, and when Star Trek VI happened, and you know, that was kind of the send off for the original era. And then we started getting Next Generation movies. I was, you know, I was a kid. I was still a kid at that point. I was really excited about now we're going to get six, at least, you know, two or three awesome Next Generation crew movies. And then we never actually really got that. You know, Generations, in my opinion, is kind of mediocre. First Contact is pretty good. And then Insurrection and Nemesis are both just not very good movies. And it just kind of petered out after that. And so I was always really... when I first heard about this, they're going to do a reboot, and it's going to be Abrams, I was completely on board with the idea of a reboot and a reimagining in concept. The theory of that, I'm perfectly fine with. I'm not as much time as I've invested in the original canon and as long as I've been a fan of it, I don't mind somebody else coming along and saying, this is our own separate thing and we're doing our own separate thing that's separate. In theory, I'm okay with that, but there's certain aspects of the execution that I'm not completely on board with.
Okay. Yeah, we'll talk about those.
Let me ask a question real quick.
Yeah.
How did you do at getting people into Star Trek? Like after Voyager ended, it was sort of the years of Enterprise and Nemesis, and then after, was the excitement there to make other people fans? Were you able to?
No, not really. I mean, I've never really tried or bothered to try. It's just, it's my thing, and... Because I grew up in the kind of that stereotypical, you know, oh, I'm a Star Trek nerd and you get made fun of and you don't really have much of a social. So I had, you know, a few nerd friends in middle school and whatnot. And, you know, we all liked nerdy things, even if they weren't necessarily the same nerdy things. And we didn't really, you know, the idea of inducting other people into geek culture was just not a thing back then. Yeah. And then as Voyager got worse than the movies, it's like, well, it just, it's the longer something is bad, the more enthusiasm it just saps from you.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's harder to get people in there.
Yeah.
So Lisa, I'm curious now, because you said that you kind of came in through JJ's movie, even though you knew TOS, but you came in through that to become more of a fan. So maybe the idea of a reboot is a little bit unique for you in terms, maybe compared to the way that we view it.
Yeah. Well, I forgot to mention, I did watch a lot of Next Generation, was as a pretty big fan when it came out. But when the movies came out, and I kind of watched them with interest, and you know, and then I'd start reading about the reviews, like you guys did, and they were starting to get worse and worse, and I kind of didn't want to go see them because I had such fond memories of Next Generation that I didn't want to screw them up by watching poorly made films. So I kind of, you know, and I watched a little bit of DS9, maybe a little bit of Voyager, but and they were great, but they weren't Captain Picard, and they weren't. I tend to find one thing and become really quite attached to it, and it's hard to really like something else for me. And so when I heard about the movie coming out, and I, you know, kind of gave it some passing thought. And then my husband, when it came out, my husband invited me to out on a date while my son was in school to go watch Star Trek during the lunch hour. And I said, sure, sounds like fun. And I saw the movie and it just blew me away. It was just like, I mean, when I first saw the Enterprise, you know, when they first showed it with Kirk and McCoy in the shuttlecraft looking over the Enterprise as they were coming up to it, I just I just started getting kind of choked up. And then pretty soon, all these references to, you know, I watched the movies growing up. I watched the Wrath of Khan and you know, all the original series movies, and you know, and then it'd been a while, but when I saw it, it just kind of struck me as really intense, I guess. I was so impressed, and I remember thinking, well, gee, Zachary, is it Quinto? I'm sorry, Zachary Quinto.
Yeah.
seemed at the time, because I hadn't really seen TOS in so long, I thought, gosh, Zachary Quinto looks more like Spock than Leonard Nimoy. So
yeah, in a way.
So at the time, so I went, like I said, about the time, Netflix was streaming all three seasons of the original series, and I don't know if it had to do with the, you know, the movie being out. So I turned it on, and I thought, geez, no. This is incredible stuff.
Yeah.
It's beautifully produced. It's kind of cheesy, but it's just, it's gorgeous. It's art. And
So this kind of pulled you back in.
Not only back, not only back in, but just in, period. Mm.
So the idea of the reboot for me, my two cents on the reboot was that it's something that Star Trek really, really needed. You know, I've been a Star Trek fan my whole life, and I grew up watching TOS when it was first getting into reruns. So I've watched all the newer series and first run as they've come out. And I really felt that from around the middle of Voyager on to the end of Enterprise that, like Brian said, we were just kind of running out of steam. Mm-hmm. And in the films, when we got to Insurrection, it felt like the studio was going through the motions. Mm. And I really felt like the franchise was dying. Yeah. And it needed some kind of shot in the arm to get it going again. And the core Star Trek audience were getting older and older and older, and they have to find a way to reconnect, or not reconnect, but they have to find a way to connect with a new audience, a younger audience. And so I thought the idea of doing a reboot was a great idea, as long as they put it in able hands, mm-hmm. which I think they did with JJ. And so I was very excited about it. And I'm a creative professional. So from a creative standpoint, I have no problem with, personally, I have no problem with this idea of kind of charting new territory creatively, if you can make it work,
right.
Which I think that they found a way to make it work.
Yeah.
So I think it's a great idea. And in the process of rebooting, of course, they have to recast all of these characters again.
Yeah.
And what I found interesting in the recasting is the lengths to which they appear to have taken appearance into account to choose actors who look similar to the original actors.
Yeah, it's really impressive when you look at Chris Pine, you know, just the way he carries himself, the way he talks. He's not doing an impression like Carl Urban's doing of Bones, but just the way he carries himself and acts, it feels like Kirk, even though maybe he doesn't quite look like Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
I think they really nailed that casting.
Yeah, they did. And I know what you mean about Carl Urban. There are moments where it feels like he's doing an impression of DeForest Kelly, but then there's a lot of times where it doesn't. So I don't think he's not playing it to the point of it being like a parody of Bones. Mm. But
I've heard some complaints about that. What do you guys think about any of the casting?
I like the casting for the most part.
Yeah.
I can see Carl Urban is kind of, especially if you look at some of his other roles, he's very much look at me act kind of an actor.
Which I just rewatched really... Chronicles of Riddick. It's like,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah. I think that's probably his worst. Yeah. I think Zachary Quinto does a great job, and I think Chris Pine had to walk a very difficult line, and he was very hesitant or very wary about taking the role in the first place because he thought, oh, I'm going to have to do a Shatner impression, and I don't want to do that. And Abrams and kind of the rest of the creative team are like, no, we want to do your own take. We want to, we don't want you to do an impression. We want you to, be you. But, there's below doing an impression of another actor, there's the essence of the character. And I think Chris Pine got the essence of the character without resorting to doing an impression.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I agree there.
Especially the essence. Zachary Quinto got the essence of Spock.
Yes. And that's a thing for Lisa to tell us about because Lisa loves Spock.
I love Spock.
And And so how do you feel about Zachary Quinto in the
role? Well, you know, I thought he did a really good job. And as I said before, when I saw him, I thought, geez, he really seems more like Spock than Spock, than Leonard Nimoy. And so I went and did some comparison and just really found myself crazy for Leonard Nimoy's version of Spock.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's just my absolute favorite character, as Chris will tell you. So now I'm actually having a hard time seeing Quinto as Spock. I think, well, his voice is too high. Well,
oh,
his
really?
Mannerisms are too sarcastic. Well, you know, and I was watching it today, and I was thinking, he did a good job, but not quite how I see Spock. The other characters, I think, did a really good job. Quinto did, too. It's just my problem is I'm such a big fan of Nimoy. For me, it's hard to have anybody else be him, and it's not Quinto's fault. I really did like Urban's version of McCoy. I'm a big DeForest Kelly fan, and I thought he did a nice job. I thought everybody else did a pretty good job, too. I enjoy those characters.
Yeah, Greg and I were talking briefly earlier about Sulu.
Yeah.
And I like this Sulu more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, we've been talking Ooh. About yeah. Well, let me first say my
okay,
piece.
Okay, Brian, you chime in on Sulu here.
Well, I know there's some uproar when John Cho, right, was cast
yep.
because he's Korean and, you know, George Takei is Japanese, or the character of Sulu is Japanese, and there was some issues with that. But I like John Cho as an actor. I just don't think I don't know. He wasn't given anything in that movie to really distinguish him or Sulu as a character in that the way, you know, Kirk and Spock did.
That's true.
So
although
like
he did get to use his fencing skills.
Yeah.
yes.
I mean, there's so many characters. It's a thing about Star Trek that they sort of made every single person on the bridge be a character, even though maybe they don't have that much interesting to do every episode. And so I thought, you know, Sulu was there. He had his thing where he left the parking brake on. He had the fencing with the magical sword. I thought he had enough. And what I love about him is when you look at his face, you can see, like, he's really thinking about doing his job. And I felt like there was a character there. And when I look at George Takei doing Sulu, especially in the movies, he looks like he's just, I don't know, having fun more than being a Starfleet officer.
You think so?
You mean Sulu
know.
As an officer is just having fun on the bridge?
Yeah.
Or if George
I could
Takei
be completely off base here.
I
think George
Takei
is just having fun.
I'd have to think about that.
Yeah.
But it's definitely very hard when you have, you know, because TV casting is just built fundamentally differently than feature casting, because you know, you have so much more time when you're on a TV show. You know, you have an hour every week for a season, 24 hours. You have a day's worth of programming versus 2 hours, and that's it for a TV show, so, or for a feature film, rather. So what you need in a TV setting is this kind of extended cast that you can rotate the pivot of a TV show around, but that becomes a liability when you get to a feature film and you have so much less time to get to know one or two characters really well and follow them along whatever particular journey they're going. So I think Star Trek might be one of the most, difficult examples in that sense of adaptation from the small screen to the big screen.
And that was one of the problems with the next gen movies is they gave pretty much everyone but Picard
absolutely.
And Data got complete short shrift.
Yes.
And it definitely that gets worse as the time goes on. If you watch Nemesis, Beverly, Crusher has like two lines or three lines, and it's all just the stupid, boring exposition. Yeah.
Well, it's like in First Contact
when
the Phoenix is going to launch and they've got Troy doing the countdown. I'm like, why the hell is Troy doing the countdown for the Phoenix launch? And then I remember, well, because they got to give her a line in the movie.
Yeah.
She had that one scene where she got drunk and that's it.
Yeah,
and it's very much something actively on screenwriters' mind of, especially in these kind of situations of, we have to give something for them to do. And, you know, when you get down to Troy or Sulu, there's not a lot left to do a lot of times, unfortunately.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, I hope they find more for these other people to do. I hope they don't become more just Kirk Spock movies as time goes on. That would be really
busy. I do too, yeah. But I wouldn't bank on it personally.
I wouldn't either.
Yeah, same here. I hope that they have more of an ensemble thing going, but probably will become a Kirk Spock.
Yeah.
They really pumped up Chekhov's role, I thought, in the movie.
That's true.
He was,
yeah, that's true.
Wunderkind.
They did, although he was my least favorite part of the movie. I guess Chekhov wasn't actually on the show at this point. So
well.
as we get into the alternate universe and continuity changes to canon and so forth, I mean, this is one of the big hurly ones.
Well, you see, when the Kelvin was destroyed, Chekhov decided to join the Academy younger because, I don't know.
For some reason.
So he joined the Academy when he was, what, 13?
Yeah.
Or what?
Well, he was 17, yeah.
He's 17 in the movie, so.
Yeah, and a full-fledged ensign at 17.
Yeah.
Or at least a cadet ensign at 17. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. And he's not Wesley Crusher, so.
Well, he is here. I mean, what they were doing.
That's true.
Was,
yeah, you're right.
They were trying to make, you know, because the joke in the original series and the movies is that Chekhov was the stupid one because, you know, he's, you know, the only reason he was on the show to begin with is because, you know, it was the Cold War and like, well, if it's a peaceful future and everybody's working together, why are there no Russians? So they put a Russian on board. But if you actually watch the original series, Chekhov's pretty stupid and they're making fun of him a lot of the times. So it was kind of their answer to that. So in this one, what they were trying to do was reverse that. And make a joke out of the reversal of it. Oh, he was an idiot before, and so now we'll make him the kid genius. Yeah.
Yeah. He really does come to save the day several times. I noticed as I was watching it earlier. Like,
well,
really?
He's running down the hall going, I can do that. I can do that.
Yeah.
Which brings me to the question of why can't they come up with a better interface for working the transporter? I mean, they need to get Apple on this because having joysticks and trying to line things up on the screen.
And have to run a mile to do it, too.
Yeah.
But about Chekhov, I mean, one thing for me, I guess what I want to see is if they do several of these movies, how is Chekhov going to evolve? Because I thought that the Russian accent was overdone. I've always thought that the Russian accent that Chekhov used in the original series was bizarre because he can't pronounce V, even though V is a primary sound in the Russian language.
It's the opposite
and
of the
doesn't
problem
exist.
He would have.
So it's kind of odd. But I thought it was done very, very they had to do it because that's from the original series. That's Chekhov's thing. But I guess what he was like very like naive and like you said, the whiz kid trying to prove himself and in this movie. Yeah. So I want to see how he evolves. You know, maybe they're starting him out that way so that they can evolve him over a few movies that he's not the kid anymore. But
well, what I'm worried about, what I fear is the case. I mean, if you look at that movie, he's not really a character in any sense. He doesn't have any kind of arc that he goes through or that he's set up to go through in later movies. He's really just a punchline, and he's used as a punchline. So he's not so much a character as he is a joke, literally. And, you know, not in the pejorative sense, but in the storytelling sense of he's just there to be the punchline. So I hope I'm wrong, but I kind of don't think that they even are thinking about what kind of arc to send Chekhov down.
What about Scotty? You know,
and that's, I mean, I don't know when you guys, at what point when you get into this, but that's really my problem, or a large part of my problem with this movie is just a lot of it is, it's, you know, goofy jokes and, you know, slapstick punchlines as opposed to, you know, characters in a situation. Chekhov is a great example of that. Scotty is a great example of that. And there are examples, you know, with Kirk and Spock and McCoy, even, you know, in the main cast, that I think are also problematic in that same kind of area.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, this is a good chance then to talk more about the story itself. And one thing for me, so we talked about the last show, Greg and I talked about the Trek films because we were talking about the Trekathon ratings. And I also just wrote an article on Trek FM this week ranking the movies. And I put this movie right in the middle. I put it 6th out of 11. And for me, the reason is that overall as a movie, if I just want to go watch a movie and watch an action movie, I really love this film. But within the context of the other Star Trek movies, when you get down to the story of this one, I think they kind of had to do this in order to reboot Star Trek and try to connect with a new audience. But they have to introduce all these characters again. And for me, the story here is very weak. And so much of the movie is just, oh, here's Spock. Here's Kirk. Oh, here's Scotty. And they're just setting up how the characters met each other. And so we have a weak story when we kind of get to the end.
Right.
So what are your feelings on the actual story element?
Yeah, I find when I sit down to watch Star Trek, I guess the 11th movie, it's not at all that I'm watching for the story. I'm just looking at the visuals. I'm just looking at what the Enterprise looks like and how everything looks like an iPad. And I'm not paying attention to what's actually happening, because as much as I love the film, really not that much happens, especially not after they leave Starfleet Academy. It's all just, let's meet this character, kill this guy, and the movie's over.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the movie feels very obligatory. It's like, oh, the point of this movie is to get them all together, so we have to get them all together, as opposed to just setting up a situation and letting your characters run through that situation however it happens. And then, you know, at the end of that going, okay, well, we do need to see this and we haven't yet, so, you know, put this in or that. It's just the movie overall feels very contrived to me. And in a lot of ways, one of the worst being... The two main storytelling problems I think exist with this movie is Nero's motivation and why he's doing what he's doing makes absolutely no sense, zero sense whatsoever. And then Kirk's ascendancy to captain of the Enterprise inside of 15 minutes also just strains credibility.
Right.
Yeah. Definitely that part especially.
Yeah. So those are the two main storytelling problems I have that just I can't get on board, because it's not there's no actual structure there.
Right.
It was a 2-hour exposition. It's
a 2-hour contrivance to get the cast together as we know the cast.
Yeah. I think I talked about this last episode, that just like in Generations, when Moore and Braga were given certain orders from the studio of things they had to put in the script, and this one, Orky and Kurtzman were given, you know, by the end of the movie, everyone has to be on the ship and Kirk has to be the captain, make it happen.
Right.
And they didn't do the legwork to make it actually happen. And especially they didn't do that. And then, short of even doing that, they didn't create an interesting story to happen on screen. I found one scene, let's see, it's right after Vulcan is destroyed, and everyone's sort of on the bridge, and Kirk and Spock are arguing over what they should do next. Should they go join the fleet, or should they chase down Nero? And it's the one scene in the movie that I think really shows what they can do with Star Trek, because all the characters have an opinion, they express it, they make a decision, there's even a little bit of arguing. But the rest of the movie, that doesn't really happen. Things just happen because they happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's just that they had to introduce all the characters. And if we talk about... So going from story, just the basic story, into how it relates to Star Trek as it's existed for the past four decades, changes to continuity. You talk about Nero's motivation, what he's doing. You know, I think ultimately Nero's motivation and what he's doing here is... the Orky and Kurtzman's motivation to create an alternate universe. They have said that they had to do something so drastic that it could justify the creation of an alternate timeline so that they could move forward and be free of the shackles of Star Trek canon. And that thing was the destruction of Vulcan.
Yeah.
So it had to be an event that changed Star Trek and changed the lives of the characters.
But don't you think they overreached a little bit? Like making a brand new Enterprise, having everybody become... I don't know. I feel like they overreached what the destruction of Vulcan would have actually resulted in.
Well, the problem is a lot of what they've set up as you know, new happens long before Vulcan ever gets blown up. You know, the Enterprise looks different. You know, at the beginning of the original series, the Enterprise is 20 years old, and it's already had three other previous captains in, you know, a 20-year history. And at the beginning of, you know, Star Trek 11, the Enterprise is brand new and already has all the main characters that we know on board. So it's, you know, you have to trace everything that's different about the universe down to the insanely different production design. You have to trace down to the Narada coming back in time and blowing up the Kelvin. And it's you can't really justify. I mean, it strains credibility, I guess. It strains credulity to say that this looks so massively different.
The Kelvin was even this new. Now, would you, either Brian or Lisa, would you have preferred that they just say, look, we're just rebooting, we're going to pretend that this is Star Trek and we're going to ignore all the old continuity rather than trying to do the time travel thing?
That's what I thought they were going to do at first, and I think that's part of the big problem is them trying to have it both ways and trying to make something new and still connected to the old canon. If they had just said flat out, this is totally new, totally separate, it's just, you know, that was this version of Shakespeare, that was this version of Hamlet, and this is our version of Hamlet, I would have been completely fine with that. My issue with it is the fact that they try to have it both ways, and trying to have one foot in both worlds, I think, really handicaps them in both.
So you're talking about having the same characters, but ignoring Star Trek as it was, and making a whole new Star Trek. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's been done before, right? I'm trying to think of an example.
The best example would be Battlestar, which was just it's not connected in any way, shape, or form, but it's, you know, it's the same kind of general outline. The issue with the Star Trek is the fact that they try to connect it to the old stuff, but then change everything as if it's a total reboot, but it's not a total reboot.
Right.
It's still connected to the old canon. And it's like, well, if it is connected to the old canon, you have to be more strict or more specific about what you change. Mm-hmm. But they gave themselves more carte blanche than they actually justify, if that makes sense.
I mean, can you subscribe to the many universes theory, where is this what just one of the universes where something different could have happened that caused technology to have shot forward, you know, 100, 200 years by the time, you know, Kirk took hold, or even Kirk's father took hold of a ship?
Well, that's what they're doing. Well, I don't think the technology shot forward.
Well, I mean,
a few hundred years. It was pretty much the same.
But
that's what they're doing. Yeah, it's just saying
it's
that.
It's a better looking ship than the 1960s.
It's like twice as big as the original Enterprise.
Yeah.
Well, see, for me, this is the thing for me. I personally don't have a problem with this because these type of aesthetics I kind of overlook because I'm a designer and I, you know, things evolve. Something's produced in the 60s, something's produced in the 80s, something's produced in 2009. You have different aesthetics, and I kind of disconnect the overall story from those aesthetics. You know, if they had done the original series design, art direction on this movie, it would have looked ridiculous. And if they had put carpet all over the ship, like on The Next Generation, it would have looked ridiculous. So, so I don't have a problem with that. I think there is a little bit, it's a little bit hard to swallow how the timeline diverges. And one of my problems with the story, and kind of comes into continuity, I guess, is there are just too many coincidences in how the characters meet each other.
Yeah.
I mean, Kirk meets Scotty because he gets thrown out of the ship onto Delta Vega, and Scotty happens to be only 14 kilometers away from him there.
Right.
There are just too many coincidences in how everyone met, but
And he just happens to run into the cave that Spock Prime is in.
Yeah.
But Spock Prime doesn't know that Scotty is nearby because he's very clearly surprised when they meet him. So
has been some explanation as to that, which made me feel a little better because I had a really hard time after you know.
And what is the explanation?
The explanation is that actually they cut out a few lines from Leonard Nimoy's Spock Prime's speech to Kirk, in that it's some sort of logic argument that the universe tries to write itself, and therefore Kirk will run into Spock. Spock and Kirk will run into Scotty. It's just things have gone wrong. The universe is trying to reset, and so that was their. But JJ says, JJ said he took that out because he wanted to preserve some of the mystery of Kirk and Spock's their meeting, their destiny. It seemed like a horrible coincidence, but
yeah, you kind of have to hang the lantern on it, as we say in another podcast. That you know, there's a problem here that everyone in the audience knows, and you've got to sort of let the audience know that the filmmakers know there's a problem too.
Right.
And then we can move past it.
Right. When you're telling a story, when you're making a movie, you're going to have to cheat. I mean, you're just going to have some kind of coincidence just to make the story happen. And the thing about being a filmmaker or a storyteller is you have to do that as little as humanly possible. Because if you do it too much, then the audience notices and then they get pissed off about it. If you do it just a little bit, then most audiences will be pretty forgiving about it. But one of the ways to give yourself a little more leeway is by hanging a lantern, by basically calling it out. In a certain way, as the storyteller going, I know this is crap right here. I'm as the storyteller, I'm aware of it, so please just give it to me and let's move on. And if you demonstrate that self-awareness, then you can get a little more mileage, but there is no actual, like that line that was cut out of, oh, the universe tries to write itself, that would have fallen into that category, but I guess
that would be a very Spock thing to say as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The actual justification is crap, but, you know, from a storytelling standpoint, it would have been better.
Well, the movie started out with a huge coincidence with Nero showing up with George Kirk's watch. I mean, he just poof right out of the black hole and right into George Kirk's ship.
Yeah,
and his wife just happened to be giving birth at that time to Jim.
Right.
And so the movie is rife with coincidences, but I don't know how to get past that.
Yeah,
I mean that's the problem.
I think you have to kind of give them this one as setting everything up, and then, as I've told Greg before, I want to see what they do in the next movie.
And see if
they come up with a story that's more true to the ideals of Star Trek instead of just an action movie filled with a lot of coincidences to bring everyone together.
Yeah, I guess that's the question. Like, has this set up the universe in a way that you guys are going to be happy with it, like going forward? And
First of all, I think it should be mentioned that the writer's strike happened while the writer's strike of 2007, 2008 happened while they were in the process of writing this script. So it's pretty well known that they started shooting with a script that they weren't really happy with, but they had to because of the writer's strike, unfortunately. So hopefully, I hope that a lot of the script's failings is because of that, and because that won't be the situation for this new one, that it'll be a much stronger film. That being said, I'm also worried that's probably not the case, because if you just look at a lot of, you know, big studio summer tentpole movie storytelling these days, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. I put this Star Trek in the same league as like G.I. Joe or Transformers or 2012, and if you look at the actual stories of those movies, I know, but if you actually look at how the sequence of events and the situations these characters are in, and how much sense does any of it make, and how much sense does what they all do in response to the situation they find themselves in, it all makes about the same amount of sense, which is to say, pretty much not at all. So,
well, at least they won't have these obligatory coincidences. They won't have to have all the characters meet. They won't need to make Kirk have to become captain.
Right.
At the very least, they won't have to deal with that.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, now that they've done all of that, hopefully the studio will give them a little bit more free rein to just let them tell whatever story they want to tell and not say, oh, we have to see all of them get on board. We have to, you know, everybody has to have their moments as they come on board the Enterprise for the first time and do A, B, C, and D.
and they just go, okay, just make a movie and tell a story, and hopefully with that extra latitude, they'll be able to put something a little stronger together.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. I can definitely buy going forward that, like, okay, all this happened, there were all these coincidences. I don't think it's going to affect my viewing going forward.
Yeah, I don't think it will affect me either. I kind of give them both creative license and also recognize certain things that they were forced to do here. I'm fine moving forward. Like I said, see what they do in the next movie.
Yeah.
So do you think the general audience obviously loved this movie, and it was by far the largest grossing movie in the film franchise. As for longtime Star Trek fans and TOS purists, do you think they can come to embrace the Abramsverse?
Well, I know, I have a lot of friends, you know, my best friend from college who, you know, the reason we're as good friends as we are is because we're both huge Star Trek nerds. He loves the new one, and he doesn't, you know, he doesn't have any real problem with it the way I do. And no, like, fanboy, oh, it's different, so therefore it sucks kind of problem. So I think there are a lot of diehard and, you know, longtime Star Trek fans that don't have a problem with it and like it very much. So,
And you hear from a lot of people who do hate it, especially on Twitter. I know a number of people who are diehard TOS fans who think that this movie is like the greatest sacrilege against Star Trek that there has ever been. So I guess it's, you know, of course it's going to be, there are going to be some fans who embrace it and some who don't. I know
some people who are trying to peg me with that opinion, even though it's not actually the case. A lot of people go, oh, you're a diehard Star Trek fanboy, so you hate it because it's different. And I go, no, I hate it because it's not a good story. And it's, it does certain things against Star Trek that I think are fundamental, that are bad to it. But I don't hate it because, the deflector dish.
Because runs and kisses Spock all the time.
That's the Onion video, you know, Star Trek fans decry new Star Trek movie as watchable, exciting.
Right.
Yeah. That was great.
That's not actually the objection. I mean,
exactly.
I have heard that from some people, but most people who have an objection, it's not that it's an exciting, fun movie. We love that. It's that they took a lot of shortcuts in the story.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So last question. Do you think that the Abramsverse, obviously at some point we're going to get another Star Trek television series. I'm quite confident. I don't think it's going to happen in the next year or two, but I don't think that we've seen the last of Star Trek on television. And do you think that the Abramsverse Star Trek is the future of Star Trek, or do you think this is going to be something that we get in the theaters and then on television we come back around to the Next Generation DS9 Voyager timeline, maybe picking up sometime around, say, the start of the 25th century, just a bit after Voyager ended?
I could see them doing that, but perhaps taking elements from the new Star Trek so that, it looks familiar to new fans.
Visually.
Some of the thoughts, some of the ideas, some of the pacing even. Because that's how TV now is so much different than it was back in, during Next Generation time, even from the Enterprise in the early 2000s.
Yeah, it's so different from when we used to turn a dial to change the channels.
Right.
I used to have to walk across the room.
Yeah, exactly. So,
I had to cross 5 miles in the snow, uphill both ways to change the channel.
Yeah, just to turn the rabbit ears.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I don't know if it would be as popular if it was from the Abrams universe. I don't know if it'd be well accepted
as a television series.
Right.
How about you, Greg?
Yeah, I think we talked about this a little bit last episode, but I think the Abrams universe is going to have to be the future of it, just because you don't want a lot of confusion about, which year does this take place in? Is it the future? Is it the past? I heard that Paramount had some problems with that, which is part of why the original series movies ended as Next Generation began. that they had a few years of overlap, I believe, but they were very worried that people were confused about why the ships looked different and the uniforms looked different. And I heard they were very wary about making a new Superman movie while Smallville was on the air. So I think that sort of studio worry is going to keep them from doing another Way in the Future show.
Yeah.
I find that.
Fun fact, studio executives are idiots, and they think everybody else is an idiot too.
Exactly.
So. That's true.
Yeah. I'd love to see. I mean, the jellyfish ship that we see in this movie is so cool looking and so futuristic looking. And I'd love to see, you know, what does the other Vulcan spaceships look like?
So you want to see a series called Star Trek Jellyfish.
Just about jellyfish. Yes.
And it's about that jellyfish ship.
It's a one-man
flying around
crew.
The galaxy.
Maybe we have to call Geordi every once in a while to you know, fix something. But yeah, we're just following the jellyfish.
They'd have to colonize somewhere else because there's no Vulcan for them to land on.
It's true.
Yeah, well, there will be a Vulcan colony. I think at the end of the movie, Spock Prime says that he has found a suitable colony, right?
Oh,
yeah,
that's true.
They talk about that. So I imagine that's going to play a part in future stories in some way, shape, or form.
I hope it does. Although they sort of ignored, didn't Kronos like become uninhabitable after Star Trek VI and then they never talked about it again?
Well, yeah, they mentioned something like that, but then, yeah, it was just completely forgotten.
They never do explain. I mean, there's 100 years between the events of Star Trek VI and the events of Next Generation. So, you know, I'm sure there's some unseen story where something happens, but they never do talk about, you know, what. They never give an on-screen explanation as to what happened. So
I hope they do more with Vulcan. But yeah, I don't know. I would love to see a 25th century show. What do you think, Chris? Do you think that would happen?
I think it could. I mean, I don't know. The problem with the Abrams verse for me on television is basically we're going through the original series again in an alternate timeline. And we have these specific actors now that are cast as these characters. I'm not really sure that there's interest in a TV series that takes place in this alternate timeline, but with a different crew. You know, you're not going to have like a Voyager.
Right.
Different ship, different crew taking place in the Abrams alternate timeline. I don't know if there's a big audience for that. I kind of feel like now that we've been without a new series for how long now? Has it been like 5 years, 6 years?
Since Enterprise went off the air? Yeah, about that.
Yeah. And now that we've been without Star Trek on TV for that long, the core Star Trek fan base is steeped in this 40 plus years of Star Trek history. I feel like there's probably going to be more of clamoring from the Star Trek audience to get back to that familiar universe. That's what people are going to want to see more so than a series that's set in the Abramsverse.
You know, the elephant in the room about that is, again, Vulcan's gone. What if they go back on television and, you know, back to the old universe and Vulcan's suddenly there, unless they completely ignore it? Is that going to confuse people? You know, when they see TV and there's planet. Gosh,
this
I remember,
true.
I thought it blew up.
Well, we have the one universe where Romulus is there and Vulcan isn't,
Romulus,
and the other one, it's swapped.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, what they'll say is that these two white mice, they commissioned the construction of a new Vulcan. And that's why Vulcan is now here again.
Yeah, just make
poor
sure
little
you
Arthur to Dent.
Yeah, to Dent. Arthur to Dent will be.
Yeah, as much as I will lament the loss of the, you know, the end of the original continuity, because it's what I grew up with, I don't think we'll probably ever see that again, at least on the screen, big or small. I mean, I'm sure we'll see books and comic books and whatnot, but
books for sure. Yeah.
Books, yeah. I mean, the expanded universe stuff for sure, but
yeah.
I think at this point we'll probably get at least one more, maybe two or three more Abramsverse movies, and then maybe somewhere, I think it'll be, you know, several years down the line before Star Trek goes back to the small screen, if it does. And when it does, it'll probably be after the Abrams first movies peter out, and then it'll probably be a third continuity or third take on it. I doubt it'll be connected to either two as we know it now.
That could happen. That could be interesting. Yeah, I do think we'll get at least two or three more movies here.
Yeah.
And you know, the studios could decide that they just simply don't want to do a new TV series while these movies are going on.
Right.
And
yeah.
Then, like you said, maybe after they're over, a couple of years after they're over, hear Star Trek back on television.
I think just mainly because it would be so expensive to make an Abrams Universe TV show. Just the sets are so complicated, and just I think the expectations would be so high while the movies are being made.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of filmmaking and you know, producing is it's in studios and networks are very conscious about making sure you see the value in shelling out 12 or 13 bucks, whatever it is, to go to the theater. Yeah. And they want to make sure you know it's worth your time. So when they do, you know, make these big tempo movies, it's very much an aspect of, well, we need to open it up and we need to make it big and we need to make sure we demonstrate that value to get the people into the seats. So that doesn't, they do that on purpose. And as a result, it doesn't necessarily, you know, readily translate to send one universe back to the small screen where the budget is much more limited.
Yeah.
Well, it will be interesting to see what happens down the road
anyway.
And I do hope that we get some, I hope we have new Star Trek for years to come, whether it's on the big screen or the small.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Lisa and Brian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
It's been a very interesting discussion. I think we could probably talk about this for two more hours, but I'm not sure if the listeners want to hear us for that long. So.
Oh, I love hearing myself. I just keep talking.
Oh yeah, I have my own podcast, and I can listen to myself talk for hours and hours.
Yeah, why don't you talk about that, Brian, real quick?
Tell us about your podcast, Brian.
Yeah, I do a podcast with some friends of mine. What we do is we record our own commentaries to movies, and we've been doing it for, as Greg mentioned, for over 2 years now. We have about, I think, 100 episodes or a few about that.
Oh, wow.
Over time, it's evolved into us kind of dissecting a movie for its story and whether or not, you know, a movie works for us or whether it doesn't for various reasons, and with a particular focus on story. We have a lot of movies. So if you have a list of five movies that you like a bunch or, you know, that are important to you, chances are one of them is probably on the list. So it's called Down in Front. So if you want to go to downinfront.net and check it out, I would, I highly recommend it because quite frankly, I think it's a pretty damn good podcast.
I think we'll put a link to your Star Trek episode in the show notes. People can check out.
You should also check out our, we have a thread for, you know, every time we release an episode, we have a thread for that episode. And our thread for that Star Trek episode is quite the conversation because
it was pretty epic.
I get quite a bit of heat, including from Greg himself, yes, about my views about the Star Trek film. So head on over to downinfront.net and find our forum and join in if you like.
Okay, excellent. And I think we can find you on Twitter as well, right?
Yep, Twitter, brianfinifter.com. So BRIANFINIFTER.
Okay. And Lisa is our editor for Trek FM. And Lisa, we can find you on Twitter as well.
You certainly can. I'm at Star Trek Rec, WREK. No C in there. Saves me a space.
One precious character.
One precious character.
It's like you have 141 characters.
That's right. I am extra special. Star Trek Rec. And I love to talk about Trek. So come talk with me and I'll take your ear off.
Yeah. And everyone visit Trek FM, especially the Captain's Log section. And Lisa writes feature articles in there, including her fashion tips for Spock.
I am all about fashion. In fact, I was noticing about the fashion today in the 2009 movie, and I didn't think it was so great.
We need a sequel.
That's another podcast altogether.
We need a follow-up article.
Yes, we do.
To your Nimoy article.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks again, Lisa and Brian.
Thank you guys for joining us.
Great to have you.
Thank you guys.
Well, I thought that was a great discussion, Chris. I'm glad we could have Brian and Lisa with us today.
Yeah, it was really interesting. There were so many more points I wanted to bring up, but I'm not sure the listeners are up for a three-hour podcast. So
maybe down the road, we'll see what people think.
Yeah, maybe we'll revisit this. So everyone, if you have thoughts on the J.J. Abrams reboot, anything we talked about here, or how this plays into TOS and your love of TOS, drop us a message.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear from you. You can head over to the website, of course, trek.fm/contact, and you can drop us a note there. And if you want to leave us a voicemail, you can do that too. Just call us at 646-652-TREK. And you can also find us on Twitter. Trek FM on Twitter is just simply Trek FM. And Greg, you're on Twitter as well.
Yep. So you can find my personal account at Greg Harbin, G-R-E-G-H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N. And I'll be talking about Star Trek and Apple and Japan and various other things, but a lot of Star Trek on there.
A lot of Star Trek. A lot about your love of whales. And sorry. And I'm on Twitter as well. C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And also, while you're hanging around our site, be sure to try your hand at Trek Trivia. See how high your Trek IQ is. Just go to trek.fm/trektrivia. We have a new quiz every week, and we have an exclusive badge that you can win if you get all 12 questions correct. The current badge is the Breen. That's right. Ooh. That's the Princess Leia as Bosch, as seen on Deep Space Nine. And
I never noticed. You're exactly right.
It is. So try Trek Trivia. And several times a week, you can play Trek Trivia live on Twitter. Just follow Trek Trivia on Twitter. And Mark Stamper and Anthony Davis host live sessions. And that's pretty much it for the show for this week. Yeah. Just let us hear from you. And oh, pick up our newsletter, trek.fm/subscribe. And you'll get news, new shows coming out every Monday, what's coming up, also some exclusive content there. So, Greg, it looks like another show's done.
I think so. I think we can stick a batleth in it.
All right, let's stick a batleth in it. It's done.